This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
A mid-morning dance with the devil from the Farmer of Fury.
It's more like Boris Karloff.
Dangerous mid-morning debate with the Great Dictator.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. The snowflakes have been falling at Downing Street this morning, but there's still no sign of a full-blown revolt on the Brexit barricades. We were hearing from Ross Kempsall in the last hour that it's been a relatively quiet week, but there's still lots of game playing going on. Jacob Rees-Mogg is already urging the Prime Minister to shut down Parliament in order to stop any kind of no-deal Brexit from being forced through. Also, of course, we've got Airbus and their boss Tom Enders saying, well, of course, if there is a no-deal, we'll all have to leave the country, because there won't be any investment in the UK. You'd expect that from him. It's an Anglo-French company, and I wouldn't think that it makes any difference to anybody whatsoever. Coming up in this hour, though, we'll take more of your calls, 0344 499 1000, and we'll find out why fracking is not as dangerous as everybody wants us to believe that it is. First up, though, we're going to talk to Dr. Helen Stokes-Lampard, chair of the Royal College of GPs, because it turns out that Matt Hancock has come up with another great plan to use loads and loads of taxpayers' money, millions, in fact, to subsidise drug companies to make the drugs that they should already be making anyway and selling to us. It makes no sense to me. I'm hoping that she'll be able to tell us why this is happening. 0344 499 1000. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
So we get told on a regular basis that, you know, our children can't get antibiotics, that we can't get antibiotics, because it may well be that the antibiotics that we're being given is going to make everybody immune to antibiotics, and so therefore we shouldn't have them anyway. Well, that's medicine. I don't see the point of having medicine if you don't actually get to be given it in order to get better if you're suffering from something that it can cure. We now find ourselves in a rather bizarre situation whereby the companies that make all of these drugs only make the drugs that make the money, which I suppose makes sense up to a point. But one of the reasons they don't make some drugs is because they know that the doctors won't give them away. It's a rather strange and curious circle to square, and we're going to seek the advice and the help of Dr. Helen Stokes-Lampard, chair of the Royal College of GPs, to see if we can find out how to get through this particular maze and miasma. Dr. Helen, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. I know it sounds slightly cynical that I'm making this particular case, but surely it makes no sense for the NHS to subsidise a drug company to make drugs that they then sell back to us for which we pay them.
Well, it does sound bizarre, but actually this is, when you think it through, it makes a lot more sense. So let me try and explain.
Okay.
So essentially, antibiotics are drugs that we should only use when people have bacterial infections that will respond to them. So you're going to be really sick and need something really quite serious to work for you.
Mm.
Over the years, we've had many wonderful antibiotics. It all started with penicillin. But what happens is the bugs have evolved and the bugs become resistant to the drugs we're giving them. So it's the bugs that do the evolving. And so we're running out of options. We're having more and more what we call resistant infections developing. So we do need more antibiotics. I think we're all agreed on that.
Mm.
The problem is it's not a cost-effective thing for a pharmaceutical company to invest in the research. So to create new drugs takes many, many years, decades sometimes.
Right.
And it's very expensive to do. It costs many millions to do it. And, of course, for antibiotics, they're used for a relatively short amount of time and quite intensively. If a drug company spends all their money making a drug, let's say, for diabetes or high blood pressure, people take those 30, 40, 50 years. So the market and the payback to the drug company is huge and over a long time. For antibiotics, It's a short period of time that they get any money for. So what? And so we've had no new class of antibiotics for over 30 years. That's why we're in such a pickle. And so there have been lots of things tried. Nothing else has worked. And so now the NHS, like healthcare systems around the world, is getting quite desperate. I mean, last year, over 2,000 people died in the UK because of these super resistant infections. So we are getting very concerned. And so one way forward is for the NHS to collaborate better with the pharmaceutical industry. And we have got an amazing pharmaceutical industry in the UK. And to invest in them, to give them reassurance that they're not going to go bankrupt trying to solve the antibiotic crisis, but that it's in the NHS's interest for them to come up with the drugs.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense, but I've got a couple of questions for you. One, I don't think the pharmaceutical business is in any danger of going out of business anytime soon, because whatever happens in the world, you do know that people are going to get sick and they're going to need medicine. What I've always wondered about is why, and I know at the risk of being labelled some kind of Corbynista Venezuelan maniac, why don't we make our own drugs in this country? Why don't we actually form ourselves a company that the government runs, that the government owns, which is sort of for the people, by the people, and which does not then profiteer off the people?
You certainly could do that. I mean, and I've always thought, why doesn't the NHS make its own needles and syringes and blood-taking bottles and all? And there are so many things. I mean, there is an argument, however, that the NHS does the caring and the delivery of care bit, and others do what they do well. And I think, you know, I'm certainly not going to get into the party politics of it, but there are plenty of commercial organisations that would say we can do it better and more efficiently than you can do it, because this is our area.
Yeah, but one of the things, and I would say they're probably right to say that. However, one of the areas of expertise the NHS does not have is negotiating contracts, because they pay way over the odds for everything. So in fact, it would be better if they knew what they were making for their own purposes, and use that kind of expertise, if you like, so they wouldn't have to sort of negotiate the deals, because it's such a big organisation. I mean, it's like a country. The NHS, you know, we ought to be able to get companies to be begging us to give them business, because there's so much of it.
I really suggest you, why don't you pitch that question to Simon Stevens, chief executive of the NHS? I'd love to hear his answer.
Yeah, well, I may pitch it to Matt Hancock, actually, because, I mean, he's a relatively new Minister of Health, isn't he? He's sort of a guy who might need a bit of help on that front. But, I mean, is that also a problem for you? And I know that Jeremy Hunt had said that he wanted to stay inside the NHS for as long as he possibly could. But, of course, he was lured away by the foreign office job. I mean, is it a problem that we don't have sort of experts at the very top politically?
Well, having a Secretary of State, I mean, let's be clear, any Secretary of State comes in not necessarily knowing a huge amount about the brief. They're reliant on the team around them. But their job is to steer a course and to be supportive in Parliament and to fight in Parliament for their bit. So Matt Hancock, new Secretary of State, has been fighting very hard for healthcare in England. And bear in mind, the health is a devolved issue, so it's England only. And so they bring fresh ideas and fresh energy to the post. I mean, the NHS in England, Simon Stevens is, say, the chief executive there. And the important thing for me is that we see close working at those very high levels, that our ministers, chief executive of the NHS, the heads of the Royal Colleges, the trades unions are working together to deliver the best possible healthcare, because that's what patients need. They don't want us fighting and squabbling. They want us seeking solutions and lobbying government to get the maximum resources in the NHS.
Yes.
So I would argue that I'm worried less about the medical knowledge of the senior minister, more about their passion for delivering great care.
Right. And what about the situation with GPs? Because I'm a parent, and so I know how hard it is sometimes to get drugs for your kids. And I'm not stupid enough to think that I should get antibiotics when they wouldn't be any good. But what I do know is that when one of my kids does get an infection which would be cured by antibiotics, and we know exactly which one to get, that you still can't get it until you go back for a second time, you know, having said to the doctor, well, I'm sorry, we've now been 6 days with a terrible infection, which could have been cured in one day if you'd just given us the drugs last week.
I know, and this is the classic damned if you do and damned if you don't situation that GPs are in. So we're under constant pressure to use fewer and fewer antibiotics, yet the report out today implies that still up to 1 in 5 of the prescriptions we give in general practice may not be necessary. Now, I would argue that you don't know until after the event, until if it was necessary or not. And that's the challenge that we face. If we don't treat early enough, then people can go on to develop bad complications. But we do know that we're using too many antibiotics overall. So it's always that dilemma. And because we've got a very stressed NHS at the moment, we simply don't have enough GPs, we don't have enough nurses and other people in our team, then we're rushed and under pressure, and people find it difficult to get through the door. So there's always that anxiety about, will I be able to come back for a prescription? And what some GPs do is use a deferred prescription system and say, look, if this is not better in 3-4 days time or you're deteriorating, there will be a prescription available for you. I will create it, so you just you don't need the appointment.
Yeah.
I will leave it to your judgment to pick it up, and that does work in some situations.
That would be good, actually.
There are various workarounds.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you've got a child with a recurrent problem, then that may be something to discuss with the GP at a future date.
Well, you know what it's like. I mean, I've got one son who gets earache from time to time. You know, it's always the same. It's just the way that his body kind of somehow accepts infection. You know, you get sometimes I used to get bad throat when I was a kid. You know, and when he gets an earache, he needs antibiotics to fix it, and it's just gone in a day. If he doesn't get them, he's in pain for like a week until he gets them. And we just always know as parents, and I know that not all parents are as brilliant as I am, obviously. I'm joking, by the way. But you know what I mean? It's kind of, we do know what's going on a lot of the time with our own children.
And as I said, this is that ongoing balancing act. And this is one of those situations where having a good relationship with a known GP can really help.
Yeah.
And again, in a stress system, having that continuity of care can be hard. What I wouldn't want, however, is for us to be saying, oh, well, anytime your child has an ear infection, here, have some antibiotics because we're making a special case. Because in time, your child will grow out of this problem. The antibiotics be necessary, everything will move on. And if we do keep throwing antibiotics at it every time, then the risk is they'll stop working for your child anyway, and then we all lose. So it is, you know, Mike, it's complex. I think we've got to recognise the GP is a professional doing a tricky balancing act. The NHS is a system under pressure. But the whole antibiotic challenge is much wider than just the NHS and general practice. I mean, huge amount of antibiotics used in hospital operations, I mean, quite understandably, but are they always necessary?
Yeah.
Huge amount of antibiotics used in agriculture, farming industry.
Well, that was something, that was something one particular GP pointed out to me on this show some weeks ago, that if we were really serious about eradicating the overuse of antibiotics, we'd stop the use of it in animal feed.
Well, and that is part of this new plan that's coming out today that Matt Hancock's talking about, is actually rolling that together. Now, responsible farmers and responsible vets have been doing this for some time, but I think the difficulty is that when you put antibiotics in animal feed and so on, you seem to improve, do things more cheaply. And you know, we do demand our food very cheap in the UK, and we might have to accept costs may rise a bit, but this is a national and it's a global problem. And obviously I want us all to work together to find solutions and work with the responsible food suppliers, the responsible vets, to come up with the right answers, because we don't want animals suffering unnecessarily either.
No, sure. One final question actually from a listener, if you don't mind, Dr. Helen, and it says this: can you ask why the drug companies charge something like £200 for 28 tablets of liothyronine in this country, and it's only about £15 in Germany?
Okay, so that's a very specific question about a specific supply and demand issue.
Yeah.
Liothyronine is not a commonly used drug. The normal levothyroxine, this is a drug for people with thyroid problems, deficiency of the thyroid gland. It's a peculiar problem that we've got. There have been worldwide supply problems of it, and it's variable. Sometimes it's expensive and sometimes it's not. So very contentious. It's very topical. Lots of people are talking about it, and the NHS is trying to negotiate the best deals it can on drugs. But occasionally, when there's a shortage, you get supply that influences the price.
Yeah, well, of course, if you listen to some people in this current political climate, we won't have any drugs soon anyway, because we're leaving the European Union, and we won't be able to make any.
I couldn't possibly comment.
No, of course not. I'm not going to get you into that argument. Thank you very much indeed. Dr. Helen Stokes-Lampard there, Chair of the Royal College of GPs. Clearly, it's a complete and utter mess the way that the NHS is run. Clearly, the management of the NHS needs completely being overhauled. And what I would say is it makes perfect sense for the NHS to manufacture their own stuff. It is literally like the GDP of a small country. And if they did all that, they'd, one, save a load of money, two, become a lot more efficient, and three, stop getting themselves ripped off by these drug companies, which we're now going to subsidise to the tune of millions and millions of pounds. Crazy, isn't it?
More blasted rhetoric from the Banana Republic for people who think capital punishment isn't going nearly far enough.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham
on Talk Radio.
Something like a good cheesy doctor's song, that's what I say. 03444991000 is the number. We had some very good doctor on just there, though. Helen Stokes Lampard. She can come on any time. Very, very forthright. Very, very interesting. Couldn't be too specific about certain things. However, she agreed with me that it would be much more sensible if the NHS actually bought, instead of buying the drugs that they have to buy, they actually manufactured them. It would make loads of sense. We're going to take some calls now, though. Ian is over in Palmer's Green in London. First, though, Lorraine is in Norwich. Hello, Lorraine.
Oh, hello. Good morning.
Very good morning to you. Welcome to the show. Now, you were talking earlier about this thyroid drug, which was much more expensive. And the doctor's answer was this about supply and demand. So does that mean that there's less supply in this country than there is in Germany, maybe?
No. What it means, Mike, is liothyrine is a treatment for hypothyroidism. Mm. It's one of two drugs. Thyroxine is very cost-effective, very cheap. But the liothyrene is approximately £300 for a pack of 28.
Right.
So what the doctor is actually saying is, even if you need this drug, which is complementary to the thyroxine,
right,
with some people with hypothyroidism, so they actually would benefit greatly from having this drug. They're saying now you can't have the liothyrene, you have to stick with a thyroxine that's probably pennies in comparison.
Oh, so does it do the same thing, though?
It doesn't, no. It's very complex, the thyroid. It treats the T3 in the disease, and thyroxine treats the T4.
Okay.
So the combination of two can work well, but many patients are being denied because the T3 liothyrene is so expensive.
Well, that's the other problem, isn't it? You get told because of where you live sometimes with regard to certain drugs, and I know that this is true of breast cancer drugs, that you can't get them unless you live somewhere else.
It's a postcode lottery,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is.
So they're allocating funds more to one area than others, and it's unlucky for you if you suffer from an illness.
Right.
You're just not going to get the drugs. But my quandary on this is because it's so cheap in Germany,
yeah,
and on the continent at £30 a pack, why can't the NHS have somebody source the drug at a cheaper price and sell it to the NHS that way?
Well, that's the trouble. That's one of the things they're not very good at. As I was saying to her, you know, what they're terrible at, it seems, is negotiating any kind of deal, and they get charged whatever anybody wants to charge them, and they just pay it.
It seems to be just a flat rate, a rolling contract. I mean, what could be interesting is if we do leave the EU on the 29th of March, could we then be free to negotiate with other countries out of contracts, maybe for cheaper generic drugs?
Yeah. Well, I don't see why not, because there's probably some European rule that says we have to use it from here, then we can't go to Germany to get it and all that kind of thing. It's a very good point, Lorraine. Thank you very much indeed for calling. We've got some more calls to take. I'm going to talk to Ian now, who's in North London. Hello, Ian.
Yeah, good morning, Mike.
Morning.
It's Ian Puddock. You very kindly tweet me from time to time.
I do. What have you got to say?
I just wanted to let you know, really, there was a brilliant, brilliant documentary on the BBC a few years ago, and I'm not a fan of the BBC, called Can Jerry Robinson Save the NHS? He was the former chief executive of Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
And basically, they gave him a ward up in the north of England that was hemorrhaging money. It was just a complete mess.
Right.
Huge, huge waiting list for operations. And he basically had to sort it all out and remanage the whole process. And it was three episodes filmed over 12 months.
Right.
And they didn't give him any money. So he couldn't come in and say, right, I've got more money, we can do this, we can do that.
Mm.
He had to cut the deficit and improve the services. And he did that. And at the end of it, they were interviewing him. And he said it's the hardest thing he's ever done in his whole life and he would never do it again.
Well, just trying to cut through the red tape.
Yeah. But he did it. He did it really successfully. And he shows you in the documentary over, say, three episodes how he did it. And the first episode was him for 3 months doing nothing other than walk around the hospitals talking to people, understanding and identifying the problems, posing potential solutions, but then and then discussing it at every level within the organisation. Right. And then at the end, the last 3 months was the implementation of his solutions.
Right.
And he got backlashes from the consultants. It was just a real insight into the culture of the NHS.
Yeah.
NHS.
Oh, and you're
that's
absolutely
really
right.
What he was battling against, the culture.
Well, that's it. And as I said, I mean, there's many things that they're very good at. And you know, giving free medicine at the point of sale is fantastic. However, negotiating is not their strong point. And, you know, buying stuff is not their strong point. They get ripped off everywhere they go.
The documentary illustrates that perfectly. I'd recommend people look at it on YouTube.
Mm.
But, you know, just saying, look, you know, we're going to chuck more money at the NHS isn't necessarily the solution. I'm sure it will help, but it's not. It's the answer is getting the right people in the right positions, doing negotiating and managing.
No, absolutely right. Ian, thank you very much indeed for the call. A couple of quick notes on that thyroid drug, actually. Brian says, Mike, I use that thyroid drug you were just talking about. I'm in currently Morocco, where I had to buy some. It cost me £3 for a month's supply, made in France, 1 × 28 days times 100 milligrams. And Peter says, I was trying to get that thyroid drug from the USA 1 year ago and found there was a worldwide shortage. Apparently, it's made from pig thyroids. Is there a worldwide shortage of pig organs? Well, I'm afraid I can't answer that question. I mean, we know many things here at the Independent Republic, but pig organs, not a speciality of mine, I'm afraid.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
A mid-morning dance with the devil.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
On Talk Radio.
Wait a second.
This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Some maniac's got in charge of the music system today. I've got a feeling I know who it is. There will be hell to pay, I can tell you that. How about this from Madge, who says, Mike Graham makes a good point with regards to the NHS. In Wales, we get free prescriptions. No idea why, but I remember a few years ago on holiday in Cornwall, it cost £32 for what was paracetamol with a fancy name. Well, I mean, of course, you can get free prescriptions in England, providing that you qualify for free prescriptions. I think they cost about £7 or £8 now otherwise. But certainly the way that the NHS is run economically is a complete shambles. There is no way that you would ever adopt anything that they do in any kind of business sense. Of course, they're very good at what they do in terms of delivering medicine and delivering healthcare. But what they're not very good at is dealing with money. And so giving them more money to spend is a very, very bad idea we're learning today. They're now going to hand out millions of pounds to drug companies to make them make drugs that they should be making anyway. That's the point. That is the trouble. And surely it would make more sense if the NHS just had their own drug company and manufactured their own drugs. It makes perfect sense to me and indeed to everybody else. 0344 499 1000 is the number. You can text us as well. Text the word talk to 87222 and text will cost you 25 pence plus your normal network rate. Let's talk to Malcolm Grimston now, though, who's Honorary Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for Energy Policy and Technology from Imperial College, because fracking, which is always in the news, is back in the news, because it turns out that everyone who's been telling us that fracking causes earthquakes has got it completely wrong. Malcolm, very good morning to you. Welcome.
Morning.
Thank you for joining us. Is that right? Fracking doesn't cause earthquakes?
The word earthquake carries with it, I think, impressions that are just not accurate to what we were talking about
about here, the earlier ones we were talking about was about equivalent to a pretty heavy lorry going past your front door.
Right.
And there's lots of examples. You know, living here in London, there are many places where a basement or a bottom of a hotel or whatever will be quite close to a tube line.
Yes.
You can feel the tremors of the
tube. Or you could be living next door to Robbie Williams excavating for a new swimming pool.
I don't think that's ever going to happen to me. But it's a matter of proportion with these things, and I think quite often we latch onto a word which has, you know, quite rightly quite terrifying implications,
yes,
but don't really fit this situation.
I mean, what we've seen, particularly up in the northwest of England, where there's been a few sort of fracking trials going on, is that areas around the Fylde coast and Blackpool, where we were being told, the subject of quite a lot of little earth tremors. But then, depending on who you spoke to, other people said, yeah, well, those happen all the time anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we should keep this in perspective. There is no way of getting energy that doesn't have some sort of downside, and it's a matter of balancing. Now, in the case of natural gas, if we're going to increase our dependence on wind and solar, which don't come necessarily when we need them,
right,
we're going to need to generate an awful lot of electricity with gas, let alone the gas that we burn in our homes for heating and cooking and the like. And our North Sea reserves are running quite short. So
right,
if we can find another way of doing it in the UK, there are environmental advantages of not having to ship the gas from Norway or ultimately from Iran or Russia, and also security issues and balance of payments issues. But on the other hand, you know, having an industry like this in a local area, particularly a rural area, is bound to cause disruptions, and we recognise that. And it's a matter of having to balance the pros and cons of various ways forward, rather than imagining that we can take any one of them out of context and just look at just the negatives of one particular issue.
No, sure. I mean, Quadrilla's the company concerned here, I suppose, and they were forced to suspend their fracking last year, and I think a lot of this was up in the northwest of England, because they breached the limit of 0.5 magnitude on the Richter scale, I guess, up in Lancashire. What's being suggested is that that limit is raised, which I guess is similar to what you've been saying about the types of seismic sort of episodes that are caused by all manner of things.
Yeah, and the Richter scale is a funny thing. It's what they call a log scale.
Right.
So an earthquake which is 2 on the Richter scale is 10 times the size of one that is 1, not double it.
Really?
Yeah, and so an earthquake which is 6 on the Richter scale is a million times
Blimey.
More than a scale 1. And when you start getting up to the really horrendous ones, like the ones that we've seen, for example, in the Pacific Rim or in California, where there are much bigger faults than there are in our part of the world, we're talking about earthquakes which are 100 million times, you know, level 8.
And also they've now established as well, it depends on the depth of them, doesn't it?
Yeah, indeed. The geology is fairly well understood with these kinds of things. We should also remember there's something like 2 million fracked wells around the world that have been going since the late 60s, early 70s. There's a huge amount of information about this technology that should allow us to... I mean, my belief is that regulatory standards in the UK will probably be higher than a lot of areas, which is clearly no bad thing. But, you know, it keeps coming back to saying if we don't do this, our dependence on imported gas is likely to be rather higher. As long as we don't, you know, my own view is that in the transition away from coal towards gas towards low carbon sources for climate change reasons, we should view gas as being something of a stopgap. But having said that, it is going to be a stopgap in the future. Do we want to provide it from within the UK if we possibly can?
Right.
Or do we want to get it from other parts of the world where, in addition to the challenges with getting it out of the ground, you've also got the transportation issues?
Yeah. I mean, we know a lot about Americans' experience of fracking, and they seem to use it quite freely and in quite widespread manners. Is it something that's done in lots of parts of the world? Because we seem to have a kind of, whatever the opposite of an affinity is to it, we don't seem to like the idea of it in this country.
Now, the US certainly led the way with it. And to be fair, there are very large areas of the United States where pretty much nobody lives. It's a much less densely populated country than the UK, and there are whole swathes in the middle of America where you can do these sorts of things without causing problems for local people. So we should bear that in mind, that the parallels are not precise. But nonetheless, actually, the brightest spot in terms of climate change over the last years, which is what I personally really worries me in this whole picture, is because the US fracked gas and so moved away from using so much coal for its electricity, the US is one of the relatively few countries in the world which has had really significant reductions in its greenhouse gas emissions over that over that period of time. So, again, it's pros and cons. There's no perfect answer to any of this.
No, indeed. And as far as the sort of future of fracking in this country is concerned, if you were able to get this this limit raised, if you like, to 1.5 rather than 0.5, would that make it much easier for companies other than Quadrilla to come in and then start working on the process?
Yeah, I mean, it would certainly, clearly would reduce one of the barriers. There's still a relatively, I think we're still quite at the beginning of being able to actually assess how big the fracking reserve is. We used to have these massive North Sea gas reserves, which we could drill from the North Sea. And there was a 10-year period between about 1995 when we were actually a net gas exporter because of that. We now import well over half of our natural gas, and that's probably going to be, and that's a proportion that's likely to just get bigger over the years of the next decade. Now, whether fracking can come anywhere near to replacing that or not, I don't think we know as yet. So it's important not to view this as being the answer to all of our problems. We just don't know, and there may be other barriers we come across that limit it. And so it's difficult at this stage to say very, very precisely what the potential is. But having said that, clearly, if there are barriers of this nature, which are acceptable, nobody would ever, justify changing a regulatory structure to the extent that these things were actually seriously dangerous.
Yeah.
Given that, then I'm sure that other companies would find it more interesting to explore what the potential is.
Right. Because I've got a question here from Stephen, who's tweeted in, who says, ask about the effects, please, of chemicals on groundwater due to fracking, which, again, is something that is often asked. I don't know the answer to it. What can you tell us?
No, again, and it's a perfectly fair question. The fracking is done at quite a significant depth, underneath the water table, underneath the areas where... So there is no real mixing with the water that's used to frack.
Right.
I mean, just briefly, I'm sure you listen know what fracking is. It stands for hydraulic fracturing. You've got rocks which have gas tied in with the rock structure. If you can smash those rocks open, then the gas can escape and you can use it, and you use highly pressurized water to do that. So that's what fractures the rock to let this gas get out,
and you have to effectively drill down into the earth to get that.
It's not very different from what happens with say geothermal energy, where you need to put water down at high pressure, then pass it through the rocks, and then recover the water. Both, because you can reuse quite a lot of it with some of the chemicals, but also to make sure that you're not providing a significant thing. Now, that requires testing in the local area to make sure that the chemicals aren't causing issues. But there have been so many of these done around the world. There is, as I mentioned, a huge body now of understanding of these sorts of issues. And some of the earlier scare stories, which I think some of which were just myths, quite frankly, about some of this, have now been put to rest.
Right.
But it needs properly regulating. Any industrial process can potentially cause local environmental issues, and that has to be part of the whole package.
Sure. And who has to make this decision finally, Malcolm, on the whole business of the seismic measurements?
Well, ultimately, that'll be the government regulators, and government regulates this. It'll be through the Environment Agency and through other agencies that look at this specifically. The ultimate commercial decision, of course, will be taken by the companies that want to do this. And as with all regulation, I think the aim for regulation is to end up with the best world that is possible. So the regulations could be, I mean, it's quite easy to regulate any industry out of existence, but that's not necessarily the best outcome for the environment or for people. On the other hand, it's quite easy to be so slack with your regulation that people are getting away with murder. And the key is to be in between those, so the overall outcome is beneficial for the economy as a whole and the environment as a whole, but also pays proper attention to local concerns and local environmental issues.
Okay. Malcolm, thank you very much indeed. Malcolm Grunson there, Honorary Senior Research Fellow at the Imperial College in London, talking about fracking and why it isn't perhaps as dangerous as everybody thought, but we're not yet completely convinced, are we? I mean, I still look at the way that they do it and think to myself, well, it doesn't look very safe. But I'm not against it, because, I mean, if I looked at how they get natural gas out of the North Sea, that wouldn't look particularly safe either. Or oil, indeed, out of the Texan desert. None of it's particularly safe if you're drilling into the core of the earth. But we'll take your calls on it. 0344 499 1000. If it makes it cheaper to get energy in this country, I think we should attempt to make it work. Don't you? Now, obviously, that music would suggest to you that who we're going to talk to now is somebody from Fawlty Towers, you know, possibly the worst hotel, fictitious or otherwise, in the history of British hotels. However, the headline has changed slightly this morning because in The Sun it says Faultless Towers, and it's because a B&B in Torquay has been voted the best in the world, incredibly, by TripAdvisor. It's won Traveller's Choice Award, and we're going to speak now to Julian Banner-Price from the 25 Boutique B&B to find out just how great it is. Julian, very good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. Congratulations, good. First of all, because it's never easy to win these awards because there's so much competition. But the B&B of old, I suppose, has died a death. You know, it's no longer likely to be more like Fawlty Towers, and it's more likely to be like a luxury hotel, isn't it?
Exactly. I think a lot of people in recent years have started to find out that a B&B... You can get so much more from a B&B than the sort of thing we remember from Fawlty Towers.
Which, yeah.
You know, the last episode of that went out 40 years ago. But
that's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, we still hold a real special place in our heart for Basil Fawlty. Myself and my partner that runs the 25 here in Torquay, we really enjoy Fawlty Towers, and it always gives us a giggle. But, you know, you won't find any views of herds of wildebeest sweeping majestically across the plain here. so, you know...
Yes, it's Torquay, madam, I think you'll find is the correct response, right?
Exactly. But, yeah. You know, things have moved on. You can get so much more in a B&B these days. And a lot of them, ours included, is more like stepping into like a five-star luxury hotel, but with the added element of really personal service we give our guests, and things that you probably wouldn't get in a five-star hotel.
No, indeed. And do you find yourselves busy all the year round now? Because, of course, Torquay is still very much, as it was known then, part of the English Riviera. But a lot of seaside towns in this country are kind of viewed as a little bit down on their luck these days.
Yeah, I mean, I think Torquay was down on its luck quite a few years ago. In recent years, it's seen so much investment and development. Definitely the rise of the boutique B&B has helped that. Guests expect more these days. You know, when you go away, you expect to have something more special than at home. You know, people have got better TVs, nicer bathrooms, and I don't know about you, I want to actually go somewhere that feels nicer than home.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
There's certainly a rise of that, and Torquay and the English Riviera in general have seen a real investment lately, and it's continuing, and we hope to attract a sort of a new breed of visitors. But if they expect to find shared bathrooms and a landlady at the door with a rolling pin and a curfew, then I think you probably should go somewhere else.
Yes, ring the bell after 10 and all that sort of thing. I mean, exactly. Do you have, funnily enough, we were talking about it in the office this morning, I mean, do you do sort of much in the evenings? Because that was one of the other things about B&Bs, was that you'd find that, you know, even I would say in the last 20-odd years, if, you know, I'd maybe gone a golfing trip or something and we'd stay in a B&B and you'd come back at night but there's nothing really going on. So you'd either just go to bed or you'd go back out again.
Well, you know, Torquay's become like a real vibrant hub, and on the English Riviera down here, there's, you know, it's become like a real foodie destination.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, we've got seafood down here, but lots of bars, clubs, live music. And whereas in the past, I think you used to go away on your two-week trip to a seaside resort, Torquay included, and you used to get dinner, bed and breakfast, so you'd stop in for your dinner in the evening as well and have the entertainment, almost never leave the hotel. Now, we don't do dinner here, we just do bed and breakfast, because only, you know, 10 minutes walk away is the sea.
Okay.
and lots of bars, restaurants, Michelin star restaurants, and lots of, you know, live entertainment. So everyone wants to go out now, you know, and really enjoy what the area has to offer. We've got so many attractions and a beautiful coastline. So why would you want to stay in your hotel?
Well, I mean, we can think of one or two reasons, but that's another story. What about the sort of the clientele? Do you get a lot of foreign tourists down in that part of the world? I see a lot of Dutch number plates whenever I'm down in the West Country.
Yeah, we get a lot of Dutch tourists. We get a lot of German tourists.
Right.
Torquay's is very well known for the writer Agatha Christie, who used to live here and was born here. And, you know, the Germans and the Dutch are really, and Belgians, they're really interested in that angle. So we get a lot of them. But we also get, obviously, a lot of people from the UK. Staycation's probably on the rise this year. Everyone's fed up with Brexit.
Yeah.
So we're hoping for an influx from that. But a lot of, a real mix. We're an adults-only hotel. So people really enjoy leaving their own kids behind and enjoying a weekend away from the screaming kids.
Right.
But we get lots of younger couples. Obviously, we've got a direct train down from London, so that brings in a lot of people.
Okay. Now you've only got six rooms, I'm reading here. That's quite small, isn't it?
Rooms. I wish we got more now. It's been a bit of a whirlwind.
Well, you might need to build an extension out the back for the new season.
I think we might. You know, since this news hit the wires, it's we've just been in an absolute storm of media frenzy, and that we've had to unplug the phone this morning. It's just got so.
That's great, though.
So
I mean, it must be very, very gratifying, because it's one of those businesses that, you know, it's quite a hard working world in which you're living. You probably don't get much time off. It's probably hard to take holidays. People don't appreciate exactly how much work goes into making what it is that you do.
Yeah, I think a few people I've heard said, "Oh, you know, I might plan on running a B&B when I retire."
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, when I retire, I want to retire.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I remember seeing a TV show. I can't remember what it was, but it was one of these, you know, young couple in London decides they've had enough of the rat race and they're going to go to Scotland and open up a hotel, right?
Yeah.
And they had an absolute nightmare because, of course, everything cost more than they thought it was going to do.
Absolutely.
Getting people in through the door to buy anything and get a chef that worked properly and all of that. I mean, it's a nightmare.
I mean, we do everything ourselves. We don't have any staff at all.
Right.
We're complete control freaks and like to, you know, control every part of the guest experience, from when they come up the steps, open the door, greet them, give them a glass of fizz and a world-famous chocolate brownie till the moment that they leave and wish them on their way. So we do everything from the cleaning, the cooking, the works. But we do get a bit of time off in the summer when everyone's checked in. We're only 10 minutes from the seafront here. Check them all in. We go down to the seafront ourselves in our shorts and put our feet up and have a beer looking at the our beautiful bay. So we do get time off, so don't cry too much for us.
Well, listen, I'm delighted for you. You guys sound like you're doing a great job. And if I'm ever in Torquay, I'll come and look you up.
Please look us up.
I will. Thanks very much indeed. Julian Banner-Price there from the B&B, which is the best B&B in the world. It's called the 25 Boutique B&B in Torquay. It's the25.co.uk if you want to try and get in there. But I imagine it's going to be sold out for quite a while. They've only got six rooms. What a great success story.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.